Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, reporting live from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. I am reporting with a heavy heart because, God, I don't know how to say it. There we go again. Up to 20 people have been shot in San Bernardino, California, at a social services office, the Inland Regional Center, which provides services to disabled people and others in need. There are up to 3 shooters reported inside. I guess we'll find out when it's all over. They have not secured the building. They're going door to door. The suspects are heavily armed, possibly wearing body armor. And let's all remember, all of you out there who oppose reasonable gun regulation, you are the reason these killers have the body armor. You are the reason these killers have these powerful weapons. You are the reasons 20 people are dead. Hope you enjoy playing with your guns, because you irresponsible gun owners are making responsible gun owners and non-gun owners look really bad. We'll talk more about that in the second half of the hour. I just had to express my outrage at the top, but I don't want to take any more time away from our guests, because it is another very important topic, and one that I scheduled before the shooting that's apparently going on as we talk. I have with me Beth Aker. She's a fellow at the Brookings Institution Center on Children and Families, a fellow at the Brown Center on Education Policy. We all know that the cost of education, higher education, college education, graduate school is through the roof, and a lot of people are defaulting on their student loans. The question is, why are colleges so expensive, and what, if anything, can policymakers do about it? Beth Akers, thank you for coming here on the Inside Scoop.
Thanks so much for having me today, Mark.
Yeah, sorry to begin with such a tragic beginning, but it just had to be said. Let's get into a different kind of tragedy, perhaps one not so immediately severe, but definitely one affecting millions of families. Is student loan debt higher than it's ever been now?
Yeah, absolutely. No question. There's more outstanding debt in the overall economy than there has ever been in the past. Individuals are borrowing more than they ever have, and more families, more households have student debt than have ever had it before.
Now, when I ran for office, I actually looked at the statistics on just the cost of higher education. And I knew it was much higher than it was when I went to college, and much, much higher than when my dad went to college, but I was still astounded at the price. In 30 years, the price level, the general price level, has doubled. You know, if milk costs $1, it costs $2 now. But the price level of college education has gone up 6 times, which means that even if inflation levels were constant, it's still tripled. You still pay 3 times, even after inflation, what you had to pay. My dad, when he went to school in the 60s, could work a summer job, and that paid for half of college. Those days are long, long gone. Before we get to the issues of student debt and student loans and all the details of that, tell me why college education is so much more expensive than it used to be.
Well, so you're hitting on the fact that we have seen inflation in higher education that outpaces really any other sector of the economy.
More than even healthcare, which people complain about.
Exactly, right. That's one of the highest, too, but we're still beyond that in higher education. And it is sort of a question, you know, what is going on inside the black box of higher education? But one perspective on it, coming from an economist's point of view, is the reason it's so expensive is because, for the most part, this is an investment in an asset that pays very large dividends over a long period of time. So in some way, the price is actually justified by these long-run returns that many people do see.
And people do, obviously, when they go to college, it definitely helps their future income. But just on the cost of college level, just before we get into your ideas for how to make things make it easier to borrow money, one of the things I noticed as I looked at this issue for myself when I was running for office was that teacher salaries have gone up 8 to 10%. The professor salaries, the number of students attending college has gone up a little less than 10%. Those things have gone up pretty much, you know, along with inflation, maybe even less than. What has dramatically gone up, some of it's capital programs where they build new buildings, but most of it seems to be administrators. There's twice as many administrators as there used to be a generation ago. There's actually more deans, you know, and I don't know why we need them or how that happened, but I didn't know if you had a comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, we don't really know exactly what's the driver of the cost, and it's sort of hard to say as an outsider what are justifiable expenses at the institution level and what are not. I mean, another source that you didn't mention was the decline in state support for public higher education institutions. So that's another place that
that's
we've been
true.
Talking a lot about.
That's true. I didn't know if you had a comment on the administrators before I move on.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of yet to be explored how significantly that impacts the quality of service for students. You know, we don't want to put restrictions on the type of spending that institutions can exercise, and sort of it becomes an open question whether or not this is justifiable spending, which translates to higher prices for students or not. And there's a lot of people who tend to think that it's not the right place for institutions to be spending the tuition dollars.
Now, you point out that obviously if you succeed in college, if you graduate, if you do well, the degrees are worth it. You can make a lot of money in America if you have a good college degree and you get a good job out of it. But if you don't finish college, you can be worse off than if you never went in the first place. There's an interesting Washington Post study on this that shows the various areas of the District of Columbia, of Washington, D.C. And the people who have the most debt actually are the richest areas, the northwestern part of the District of Columbia. People are in heavier debt than in the poorer areas, the southeastern portion, the Anacostia portion. But when you look at the people who have defaulted on their loans, it's the people that don't owe as much. The people who own $5,000 are much more likely to default than the people who owe $50,000. And that's sort of the focus, I guess, of what your article is, right?
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, what we're seeing is that the people who have made these large investments in high-quality education, they have a lot of debt, but it's sort of justifiable debt. It's debt that will be relieved over the course of their lifetime because they have access to this high earning. And a lot of the public conversation about debt has been providing relief to exactly those people. I think that's really a misguided narrative, and I'm glad to see that people are starting to focus on the fact that the places for distress in this sector are really among the people who have the lowest debt balances, who maybe didn't succeed in finishing college or went to a certificate program that didn't end up paying off.
And the thing is that we want to make college accessible for people of limited means, and yet it's the people of limited means who are struggling the most. So what can be done?
You know, I think what this does is pushes us in the direction of emphasizing quality. So, you know, historically we've looked at higher education. I think we've sort of conflated price with quality. We thought if it's more expensive, it must be better. Some of the research on for-profit colleges that have come out in the past year are kind of pushing against that.
I think for-profit colleges are the worst, by the way. They seem to offer the least return for the most money. They're obviously trying to make a profit off kids. They're not just trying to educate them. They're trying to make money in the same process. I don't know of any good for-profit institutions. Are there any?
Well, I guess I don't want to pick and choose, but I will say that the latest research in this area is suggesting that they're not producing good outcomes for students, and they're doing that at a very high cost, or high relative to the other alternatives, which is maybe a community college or a public institution. And so I think, again, it comes back to this idea that we need to start actually measuring quality in higher education. We need to make sure that opportunities are available for low-income students, not to just go to inexpensive places, but to go to places where the dollars that they do spend are going to produce good results for them. And that comes down to measuring more outcomes, having more data, and we've taken the step in the right direction when it came to releasing the earnings information that was posted on the White House webpage just this year.
I wonder how many of much of this is simple, fraud is a strong term, let's just say deception. I mean, I've seen those commercials, you've seen those commercials, we all have. Indeed, I suspect that a lot of the money that they make off poor people goes to these commercials where they offer you a degree in whatever, 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 and anyone can join, and you don't even have to read in order to get an IT degree. Well, you kind of have to know how to read to get an IT degree. I mean, mm-hmm. they'll take anyone, they'll be happy to take your money, but their degrees aren't really worth the paper they're printed on.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We've had this culture in this country, I'd say, for about a decade, where we're just telling everyone the golden ticket to success in this country is a bachelor's degree. And we haven't emphasized any sort of savvy shopping when it comes to choosing a college and deciding where to spend your dollars. And of course, when you cultivate that type of culture, you're going to get people shopping without paying attention to the measures of quality that we do have. And as a result, we have people making huge investments that aren't paying off. And
sure.
I think we need to shift away from that.
I just went car shopping, and you know, there are cars that are worth the money at a low price. There are cars that are worth the money at a high price, and there are cars that aren't worth the money at both a low price and a high price. And the worst part is to pay a high price for a lousy car. In terms of colleges, in order to determine how good the degree is, we do have accreditation. We have these accreditation agencies that
mm-hmm.
seem to say what's good and what's not good. Are they failing?
You know, I do believe they're failing. It's sort of inside baseball stuff. The industry is sort of, in a way, self-regulating, and there's not enough pressure, I believe, from the market on these institutions to do a better job in policing. But what I'm hopeful is that the new data sources that have come out this year on post-graduation earnings or post-withdrawal earnings are something that can be used by third parties, kind of like a U.S. News and World Report style third party, to really tell consumers what it is that they need to know about what they're buying in higher education.
Well, you know, I like Consumer Reports. Again, maybe I'm just stuck because I'm just in the process of buying a car. But
mm-hmm.
Consumer Reports, I think, would do an excellent job, or something
exactly.
like that, a neutral source. Does the government provide any kind of this neutral source to determine? I mean, you mentioned that President Obama has on his website the median salaries for graduates of
mm-hmm.
each school? That's very useful.
Right, and also probably even more important statistic there is the graduation rate, because so much of the financial hardship is coming from people actually not finishing their degree in the first place. And so, right, the government has released this data. There's some on the White House webpage. There's some on the Department of Education webpage. But the government is really not in the business of providing information to consumers in a way that's really consumable to them, right? So part of the challenge is not just making the information available, but making it available in a way that people can use it to make smart decisions. And that's where I think we're going to come in with these sort of third-party industries that develop to sort of churn that data and spit out something that people who are actually making real decisions about college can use.
Now, one of the things you talk about in your articles, and you've written a couple on this, is something you call income share agreements.
Mm-hmm.
And this is basically the idea is this. If you do well in college and you are a good student and you go to a good college and they teach you a lot of good things, you can make a ton of money by going to college. And even if it costs you a lot of money, you can make a lot back. I mean, people who pay for Harvard and Yale, they're very expensive, but tend to have pretty good outcomes. On the other hand, you can go in and pay a lot or a little, not do well in school or not have a good school, and you end up dropping out, and now you've paid money, achieved no degree, and you're worse off than you started. And you talk about it basically as an investment, that some
mm-hmm.
investments are sort of high risk, high return, and others are simply, maybe high risk, low return.
Mm-hmm.
One of your proposals is that basically the people who do well in college help subsidize those that don't. Is that a fair? I don't want to put words in your mouth. Is that sort
yep,
of what?
That's how that system would work, in effect. Yes.
Okay. So the argument that you're going to hear, and I can already hear Republicans ready for this, is, well, you know, the people that succeed in college, they're the people who work hard and study hard and open the books and listen to the teachers. And the people who don't succeed, they're the ones partying all the time, drinking, and if they're loaded with debt, they deserve what they get.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that may be true. It also may be true, I assume, that some people just can't afford to stay in college. Well, how can you tell how much of someone's failure in college is due to their own fault and how much is due to the fact that they can't afford to go?
So this is sort of a classic problem, right? So we're in essence creating insurance with a program like this, which says if you face a bad outcome, you don't do well in the labor market, you don't make enough to pay back your debts, we're going to take care of you. And any time you put those sort of safety nets in place, there is an incentive for people to take actions that are, you know, either more risky or put themselves in a less likely position of being able to repay that debt, right? People have car insurance, and so they drive faster on the highway. Maybe they don't wear their seatbelts because they know that they have insurance to cover the repercussions of those accidents. And so you have the same issue here, and that's sort of a necessary evil of having these types of safety nets. But I think, you know, we recognize the capacity to have an actual market for this insurance. It works in that way because the moral hazard isn't so strong that it overtakes the system. In this case, it's comes down to how large is that incentive for people to shirk, in essence, right? How large is the incentive for them to, you know, to not try to succeed? And it can be designed in a way that's
and I want to talk to you about how to design it, but I have to take a break. Folks, if you want to call in and discuss this topic, please feel free to do so. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275, back after this.
He's a Bible-quoting, Constitution-loving, flag-waving, red-blooded, liberal American. He's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275. And now, the voice of reason in an unreasonable world, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. My guest is Beth Carr. She's an expert on education. Beth, we don't have too much time left, but give me the essence of the plan that you propose.
You know, the idea here is that we have a system that allows people to finance the degrees that they want to purchase, but overlays an insurance policy on top, making sure that they're protected from unaffordable monthly payments, have to also fork over the upside if they do really well, and in essence, we get people protected from ever having to be in dire straits because of their borrowing for investments in education.
So this is a private plan. This is a voluntary plan.
Absolutely. I think we want to see this tested in the private market as a substitute to the current private student loans, which have no protections whatsoever right now, before we'd ever want to see moving towards a system like this in the federal system.
And what does it provide? I mean, do you think enough? Have they ever done this anywhere? I mean, has this worked?
So we've done it on very small scales and sort of these mentoring type environments with one-to-one investing, but we haven't seen it at a large scale. We haven't, you know, we haven't tried to do it at a level that would tell us whether or not it's a sustainable system. You know, to whether or not those issues of moral hazard that you raised are so significant that they create problems for the system. And so we really do need to see a model of this. It sounds like Purdue University will be maybe one of the first places where we'll see a large-scale implementation of an income share agreement, and we're waiting for news from them to see what that will look like.
And briefly, you cite the Make School in San Francisco, where basically everybody goes in for free, and then you have to pay back 25% of your salary in the 2 years after you graduate. So if you make a ton of money, that's how the school gets paid, and if you don't, you're done. You like that plan?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we're seeing is not so much a market for income share agreements right now, but institutions or colleges popping up that are financing this kind of plan themselves. And it's a way for them to be competitive with the institutions that are, you know, more traditional and have access to federal student lending. I think it's a great model and demonstrates that there's a lot of promise in this area and it may be a solution to a lot of issues we're facing in higher education right now.
I like the idea, too. I mean, how can you complain when you're earning more and you simply pay 25% back of your income you're already getting? Makes sense to me. Beth Akers of the Brookings Institute, thank you very much for coming and sharing your wisdom with us. When we come back, I got to talk about San Bernardino. Call in 888-488-MARK. Back after this.
Back to the Aggressive Progressive, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. Well, here we go again, folks. Here we go again. Round this merciless merry-go-round. 20 people apparently have been shot. I don't know how many are dead. I don't know whether there's one shooter or two or three. Apparently they're heavily armed. They may be wearing body armor. And people are dead. Innocent people are dead. Now, please don't tell me they're dead because the killers are terrorists. The killers may well be terrorists. I don't know. And please don't tell me that people are dead because the killers are mentally ill. The killers may well be mentally ill. Let me tell you something. In every population of every bit of humanity, in every spot on the planet, for all of the hundreds of thousands of years that human beings have existed, there has been some percentage of mankind that has been dangerously mentally ill. We do our best to cure it. We should. We should devote resources to it. But we're never going to eliminate all dangerously mentally ill people. Nor are we going to eliminate all terrorists. We can try. We can fight them. We can go over and bomb ISIS all we want. We can try to teach tolerance and try to teach people not to hate, like the Charleston killer or the Planned Parenthood killer or the killer of various Sikhs and Muslims or people who crucified Matthew Shepard. But I have to tell you, there are always going to be haters among us. There's always going to be terrorists. There's always going to be mentally ill. The difference between the United States and every other civilized nation on the planet, Canada, Australia, England, France, Germany, Netherlands, Japan, you name it. The difference is that they got terrorists too. They got dangerous criminals. They've got mentally ill. I assure you, what they don't have is guns. So who's at fault for these people being shot in San Bernardino? Not the terrorists. We're always going to have those. Not the mentally ill. No, the people at fault are the people that oppose gun safety regulations. The people that support making it easy for terrorists and the mentally ill to own guns. It's your fault. If you're listening to me, yes, it's your fault. Those dead people, those dead kids in Newtown, it's your fault. The people in the movie theaters crawling under the seats, trying to save their loved ones by jumping on top of them. It's your fault. And yes, even the people in Paris. It's your fault they're dead. To the extent that you want it and make it easier for terrorists to own guns. Now, who am I not blaming? I'm not blaming responsible gun owners. I'm not blaming people. If you think that I'm blaming you just because you own a gun, you're wrong. Listen to what I'm saying. You want to own a gun? You haven't committed domestic violence. You have no record of violent felonies. You're not a member of a terrorist group. You're above age. You've had training. You know how to handle a weapon. Go forth. Use your gun safely. Fine. I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about those of you, whether you own a gun or not, that want to make sure that every terrorist has access to the most sophisticated semi-automatic machine gun on the market. The ones that want to make sure that terrorists can get AK-47s and Glocks and 100-round drums and body armor. Those of you that want to make sure that those who are dangerously mentally ill and declared by a court violently insane, you want to give them weaponry. Those of you that want to give 3- and 4-year-olds loaded guns. And yes, don't joke. That was one of the laws we tried to pass in my home state of Virginia, and the Republicans shot it down because they don't see a problem with handing a loaded gun to a 3-year-old. It's your fault. It's your fault. And don't give me this, well, you know, bad guys with guns are stopped by good guys with guns. Yeah, they're stopped by police. That's true. I want the police to have more weapons than the citizenry. I do. The police aren't perfect. God knows. We've talked all about the police and Black Lives Matter. And frankly, I would have police body cameras to monitor the police because we have to. But I still want them to outarm the citizenry. Don't tell me you need a gun more powerful than a cop. Because if you have a gun more powerful than the police, I want the police to have a tank. I could just hear the next argument. Let's let the mentally ill terrorist have a tank too. I want a tank. So what if I've killed several people? I want a tank. And I know what you're going to tell me. Tanks don't kill people. people kill people. I want you to take the logic of the gun nuts all the way. If every single three-year-old terrorist deserves an AK-47, then why not a tank? Put your baby behind a tank. Put your mentally ill, schizophrenic person who hears voices telling him to kill people, put him behind a tank. There shouldn't be any restrictions. Let him have a tank. Tanks don't kill people. People kill people. If we want to stop the person with a tank, we'll just give the police planes to drop bombs on the tanks. Right in our neighborhoods of America. And if that causes a problem and you fear government tyranny, then I know what you want next. You want to give every American the right to a plane with bombs. And if bombs aren't enough, why not nuclear weapons? Why not give every ISIS person a nuclear weapon? That's what the gun nuts, in essence, what they want. Don't tell me they don't support proliferation. Why not? So you're on the terrorist watch list, so you want to kill all, fill in the blank. Blacks, Jews, Christians, Muslims, I don't know, gay people, women, people who are left-handed. There are all kinds of nutcases in the world. But the real nuts are not the nutcases. The real nuts are supposedly ordinary citizens who want to arm the nutcases. They want to arm the nutcases. Don't tell me, oh, no, you're taking away my guns. That's a load of crap, and you know it. That's BS. If you haven't committed a crime, I'm not going to take away your guns. And if you have committed a violent crime, you shouldn't complain if I take away your guns. And if you do advocate jihad or killing all the black people at your church or stringing up gay people or killing all abortion doctors, if you do advocate for that, you have a right to advocate for that, but you don't have a right to own a gun. If you think someone who's violently mentally ill should have a gun, I wonder if your sanity should be checked. 888-48-MARK, 888-48-6275. Let's go to, who do we got next? I think it's Paul in New Mexico on line one. Go ahead, Paul.
Hey, Mark. Yeah, good program. I'm real sorry about those people in California. But, you know, my initial thought was a lot of the blame goes right to the Supreme Court, who gives these people cover, you know, the NRA and gun nuts, and basically stripped away the words of well-regulated, you know, the words well-regulated in the Second Amendment.
Yeah, a well-regulated militia. It's not even that a well-regulated person. It's not, you can't just regulate a person. You have to be part of the army. You got to be part of the militia. You got to be part of the police force. We allow police to own guns. No one's right to take away police people's. What are police officers? They're a well-regulated militia. In fact, they may not even rise to the level of militia. The Second Amendment protects such a small class of people that no one's trying to take guns away from the National Guard or the Army, Air Force, or Marines. They're not. You're absolutely right. By the way, for 200-plus years, the Supreme Court held specifically that only a well-regulated militia was protected by the Second Amendment. It was only 10 years ago. So for 200 years, they ruled one way. 10 years ago, some clever theorists in the NRA came up with this idea that you should ignore the first half of the Second Amendment, and they got five justices. At a time, Chief Justice Berger used to call this argument, this is a very conservative Chief Justice in the 1990s, he called the argument ridiculous that somehow you could ignore the first half of the Second Amendment. So you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right that the five justices of the Supreme Court are just off their Looney Tunes. At the end of the day, they just don't respect the Constitution. I said this to Justice Scalia. I said it to him face to face. He has no respect for the Constitution. He has none, because the Constitution says a well-regulated militia be necessary to secure a free state. The right of people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That's what it says. If you don't like it, you're going to have to amend it. But the Second Amendment just doesn't protect the right of a mentally ill terrorist with a bunch of felonies to shoot up a health center. It just doesn't. Thank you, Paul, for bringing that up. I really do appreciate it. Toll-free number, 888-48-MARK, 888-48-6275. We'll be right back right after this.
He's a Fulbright scholar and he speaks French, but he couldn't tell you who won the Super Bowl. It's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275. And now, the voice of reason in an unreasonable world, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. I've just retweeted, and then if you don't follow me on Twitter, you should, at Mark Levine Talk, MarkLevineTalk. I just tweeted out a tweet by a political scientist, Ian Bremmer, who points out that there have been 331 days in the year thus far and 351 mass shootings. Those are shootings of 4+ victims. There have been more mass shootings this year than days in the year. So I can't blame you if you think this show is a rerun. I probably sound a lot like I do every time this happens. In fact, I rarely comment when there's just 4 dead. Usually it takes 10 or 20. If you're a longtime listener of the Inside Scoop, excuse me, pardon me, you've heard this before. Another shooting, another number of people dead. Here comes Mark. He yells in the microphone. He thinks that's going to do something, and it never does. I don't blame you. I will tell you this. I am trying to do something. I ran for office to do something about this. I do start in January. I suspect we'll have another 45 mass shootings between now and then, but I can't help that. And I also suspect it's going to be an uphill battle for me in the Virginia legislature because it's controlled by Republicans, the vast majority of whom support the right of terrorists, insane people, and toddlers to carry weapons of mass destruction. That's what they support. And who are their supporters? Who votes for these ridiculous politicians? Well, I would call them irresponsible gun owners. Because no responsible gun owner would vote for people like this, and I can't imagine a non-gun owner voting for people like this. If you're a responsible gun owner and you've had training, you know how to handle your gun, and you're not out to kill anybody, and you keep your guns locked and away from your kids and not loaded, you know how to handle it, and you would never give a loaded gun to a mentally ill person or a 5-year-old. If you're a responsible gun owner, then you couldn't possibly support these madmen, right? So it's just it's a lunatic fringe. It's a lunatic fringe who vote for these people again and again. 90%, more than 90%, 92% of Americans support background checks. Heck, we have them on half of gun sales already. Even gun sellers, gun dealers shouldn't mind background checks because they already have to perform them. But there are a few politicians who get lots of money by the gun nuts, and they carry the day. And until you, that's right, you, the person listening to my voice, until you do something about it, until you call your state legislator, and do you know who your state legislator is? Most people don't. Not your congressman, not your member of Congress, not your senator. Who represents you in the state house, wherever you live? Who's your state senator? Your state representative. If you don't know, that's okay. Most people don't. Look it up and call him or her today. As soon as I'm off the air, call them and say, what are you doing to stop these mass murders? You shouldn't have to wait until it happens in your neighborhood. Because mark my words, if we don't stop this, it will. Reggie from Georgia on line 2. How are you, sir?
Well, happy hump day to you too, Mark.
Yeah, it's hard to be very happy today. I refuse to stop getting angry. There are people who get so numb that they're just not going to get angry anymore. I'm going to get angry every single time. I'm just not going to stop.
Right, but as as I said to you before, and I'll say it again just to reiterate for you, every time you have, you know, radical right-wing hate talk rhetoric from radio or TV or politicians, things like this are bound to happen. You got mentally ill people out there who can't differentiate between reality and fiction, right?
Yeah, I hear you, Reggie, and to some extent I agree. I certainly think a lot of hate talk is disgusting and wrong and shouldn't happen and should be responded to. But here's the thing, Reggie. Here's where I come at it. I don't think we're ever going to banish hate. I mean, exactly. You know, it's something that religions would love to do. I just don't think we're ever going to banish hate. People are too petty, and they magnify differences. And I don't think we're ever going to banish hate talk. And I don't think we're ever going to end all mental illness. To me, those aren't something we can do. We can do something about. We should try to do something about. But I guarantee you there are mentally ill people in Australia. I guarantee you there are people who are hate-filled in Australia. And I guarantee you they have extremely few mass murders. I think none this year because they have very strict gun regulation.
Right. But how do we keep the gun, like as you said before, and to reiterate what you said earlier, how do we keep guns like this out of the hands of those who are, shall we say, criminals or mentally ill people?
Background checks.
Right.
Background checks, and I would go further than background checks. I would require some level of training and proficiency. When you go to buy, you know, we have out of 300 million odd Americans, I bet we got 200 million drivers at least. Of adult Americans, I would say probably 90% of us have a driver's license. Not all, but most of us.
Right.
To get a driver's license, every single one of these hundreds of millions of Americans had to go and read the little booklet and pass a written test and pass a driving test. And oh my God, I'm sure it was onerous when you were 16, but you got over it. You took your test. You even took an eye test. You got your license, and some people don't drive so well. But I guarantee you the people who failed their driving test, they're worse.
Right.
We need a gun test.
Right.
We need a gun test. You have to know how to handle it. You have to know which way, you know, you don't point it at people. You have to know whether, because some people, when they're playing with a gun for the first time, don't realize that if you empty out all the bullets, there's still one in the chamber.
Right.
Isn't that something you ought to know before you touch a gun? Most 8-year-olds don't know that. Right? And they're not expected to. They pick up a gun, they throw the bullets all out, they think, and then they have fun. They point at their little brother and pull the trigger just to scare them, because that's what kids do. And lo and behold, that 8-year-old has committed murder.
Right.
And so a basic test to own a gun. And if you're a responsible gun owner, you shouldn't mind that test.
Right. But I just hope that this tragedy doesn't get politicized yet once again either.
You know what? I hope it. No, Reggie, I want it to be politicized. People are like, don't get it political because that seems crass. You know what? If we don't make, what is politics all about? I like to think of politics as not always a bad thing. Sometimes it's a good thing. We made Vietnam political. We stopped the war in Vietnam. We made civil rights political. And we brought civil rights to America. Sometimes you should make something political in the sense of marches in the streets, grassroots demands of politicians. That's democracy in action. I don't want people to close their eyes, put their hands over their eyes and say, oh, no, not again, cry, and then go back to work in the morning. If that's all you do, you're not helping. You need to call your politicians. You know what? If you're in my district, call me. Trust me, I'm already on your side. If you have a politician who's not on your side, call them. Say, not only will I not vote for you, I'm going to campaign for your opponent. I'm going to give money to your opponent. I'm going to organize for your opponent unless you vote for background checks. Remember my name. I'm your constituent. I'm going to be your worst enemy come election time unless you do something. If you do something, I'll support you, and I'll be your best friend. If people will make those calls today, we can actually make a difference. Afraid that's all the time we have. Thank you, Reggie, for your call. I appreciate it. Look, I do get angry. I'm not going to stop getting angry. But we have to just do something about it. You can't be angry and you can't be sad. You have to channel that anger, channel that sadness, channel the tragedy into making a difference. Or these things are never going to stop, friends. They're just not. This is Mark Levine signing off.